Good morning. Thank you for joining us. We will have roll call for the ARSA meeting, please.
Chair McAdoo?
Here.
Vice Chair Trachok?
Here.
Regent Carter? Regent Lieberman? Regent Perkins?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. And we will ask for public comment. Is there public comment in Elko?
No public comment in Elko.
Okay. Any public comment in Reno?
No public comment in Reno.
Any public comment in Las Vegas? No? All right. I don't hear any, so we will move on. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yes.
I forgot about being right here. Thank you.
For the record, Stephanie Molina, M-O-L-I-N-A. Given that this body is tasked with supporting student success and ensuring a positive academic environment, I am here in front of the Student Affairs Committee to request that the management practices of the UNLV Office of Student Conduct be examined. Written policies and procedures appear to be a construct only created to placate the Board of Regents. The University of Nevada, Las Vegas has created a hostile environment in which I am being harassed and discriminated against by the Office of Student Conduct. As an enrolled doctoral student in good standing with no official academic sanctions placed on them, administration has revoked my access to academic labs and offices as an act of retaliation for notifying university administration of a professional and personal matter that has been deceitfully handled. UNLV administrators are aware that I am in the data collection and analysis stages of my dissertation project and have thus taken these discriminatory actions to keep me from successfully completing my program. Furthermore, this is also impacting my coursework, given that I am enrolled in guided research credits and research assistantship, both of which require lab access for me to produce data for submission to my academic department. Furthermore, the director of the UNLV Office of Student Conduct has engaged in harassment that can be considered borderline stalking behavior. For instance, the director attended a Saturday campus event, which he knew I would be in attendance, simply to intimidate and harass. The director has also waited for me outside of a meeting with police presence to tell me that I was being allowed into the meeting because I am a student when this meeting was in fact an open meeting subject to NRS 241. He has been following me around to remind me that I am not allowed to partake in activities which are open to the public in an institution with an open campus. Moreover, when I asked that the alleged notification letter stating these unreasonable sanctions be shown to me, he is unable to produce a document and instead produces a so-called quote-unquote reminder notification, which is simply harassing in nature given that he never provided the original notification. So my question here is, does the director of the Office of Student Conduct follow all students around who pass through his office? I do not believe he does. And as such, I am asking the committee to make a recommendation to the board that correction of policies and procedures of the UNLV Office of Student Conduct be examined and that the actions of this employee be scrutinized to determine if they are acceptable. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other public comment? All right. We will move on to item number 2 for the minutes. I will entertain a motion to approve those.
So moved.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Motion from Laura Perkins and second from Regent Trachok. Thank you. And are there any discussion on the minutes? Questions? All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
I vote aye as well. The minutes pass. To agenda item number 3 for the Regent Awards.
Chair McAdoo, also ask if there are any nays to the motion for the minutes.
If there are any what?
Nays, no votes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are there any no votes for the minutes? I thought I heard all ayes. Okay.
Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you. All right. So we will now move to agenda item number 3, the Regents Awards, and Vice Chancellor Abba will take care of that. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic Student Affairs. I will read into the record the nominations that are recommended to receive the various research awards. I do apologize in advance if I mispronounce any of these names, but I'll do my best. For the Nevada Regents Creative Activities Award, the Community College Award will go to Mark Wary at CSN. For the University and State College Award, Dimitri Adepine from UNR. For the Nevada Regents Teaching Award, the non-tenure, tenure-track Community College Award will go to Chris Aguilar at CSN. For the tenured, tenure-track Community College Award, Kenya Cockney, from WNC. For the non-tenure, tenure-track University, State College, and DRI Award, Carrie Francis from UNLV. From the tenure and tenure-track University, State College, and DRI Award, Sarah Harris from UNLV. For the Nevada Regents Academic Advisor Award from the Community Colleges, Jennifer Pierce from TMCC. The Undergraduate Four-Year Institution Award, Grace Leal from UNR. The Graduate Award for the Four-Year Institutions in DRI, Ann Leonard at UNR. For the Nevada Regents Researcher Award, UNR, the Distinguished Award will go to Kenton M. Sanders from UNR and Wee Yan from UNR for the Mid-Career Award. For the Nevada Regents Rising Researcher Award, Mark Hosner from DRI, Ashkan Salamat from UNLV, Mozart Fonseca from UNR, Costas Alexis from UNR. I would ask that if any of these individuals are present, to please stand so that the committee may acknowledge you.
And we also have Mark from the DRI up here.
Oh, congratulations, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is an action item, so I will need a motion.
So moved.
Second.
And a second from Regent Lieberman. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 I vote aye as well. Are there any noes? All right. That passes, and congratulations to all of you. That's a fun part of this job. Thank you. All right. Agenda item number 4, UNLV program proposal for the Master of Science in Cybersecurity. Thank you, Provost Heavey.
Good morning. Chris Heavey, Interim Provost at UNLV, for the record. I'm delighted to be before you today to ask for final approval of a new master's program in cybersecurity at UNLV. I think everyone in the room is aware of the tremendous need to have additional trained professionals in this area, and we are proposing an interdisciplinary program that will exist at UNLV and be staffed by existing faculty from our Lee Business School and our Howard Hughes College of Engineering. Be a 30-credit master's program that students will complete during 2 years of training, and it will hopefully help to fulfill the tremendous need in our community for people in this area. Happy to answer any questions if there are any, but we're excited to see this program launch in the coming year.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I will entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Say no. I vote aye as well. Motion passes. Thank you. All right. And so agenda item number 5, TMCC, the program proposal for the BAS Career and Technical Education.
Thank you. For the record, Marie Mergolo from TMCC. Thank you for the opportunity to present for your approval TMCC's Bachelor of Applied Science in Career and Technical Education and Leadership. For the record, the name should be Bachelor of Applied Science, Career and Technical Education and Leadership. In the document in your package, and leadership is not in there. I apologize for this omission on our part. I've spoken to the Vice Chancellor, and she is in support of correcting the name at this time. Basically, this BAS in CTEL is a degree designed for associate degree earners, especially Associate of Applied Science degree earners. The degree will serve many purposes, including it inspires and motivates students to complete their AAS degrees. A lot of students are hireable after finishing core classes in their CTE program, and they don't stay on to finish the degree because they don't see it as a path to further education. This provides that pathway. It also provides them with an opportunity to move out of their technician positions and into management positions or onto educational institutions. And it'll be a really big help in that area because a lot of community colleges and high schools find it difficult, especially in an employment situation such as we have, to find properly qualified instructors in the CTE area. Many times the high schools will hire an instructor that has the industry qualifications, but they, within the time allotted, are not able to earn the bachelor's degree. And this is because a regular Bachelor of Arts or Science doesn't accept a lot of the credits earned in an AAS degree. This degree will accept all of those credits earned and create a more direct, quicker pathway for these students to advance their education, excuse me, and to get the qualifications they need to continue their employment. Another problem that we see are a lot of times parents will dissuade their children from going into CTE programs, although the workforce greatly needs those qualified people, because they see it as an end path. They don't understand that, you know, now that there's a BAS, they will understand that students will have the opportunity to move into management roles and into educational situations. It increases their career opportunities. They could work in corporate or educational management, corporate training, high school or community college instructional positions, education administration, and those are just a few examples of what it opens up. Also, please note that in the documentation, the articulation agreements with CSN and WNC that were in progress are now completed. So in closing, I'd just like to say that the BAS CTEL degree is really a win-win for our community, for industry, for education, parents, and most importantly, for our students. Thank you. If you have any questions.
I have a question.
Yes.
Yes, Chair Regent Trachuk, I guess I'm chair.
Thank you. Did I understand you correctly when you said that the BAS program would encourage students to complete their AAS degree?
Yes, because a lot of students will stop out before they finish their AAS degree because once they do the, you know, the technical career-directed classes, and we have employers waiting in the lobby, and they hire these students as they walk out of their classrooms, and the students think, well, why should I go back and, you know, finish the general education requirements of this? It's not going, you know, I can't do anything with it. I can't go further with it. But if they realize, well, you know, I can actually go on and do a bachelor's degree, get the four-year degree that business and industry require for me to move into a supervisor or a management role, then they will, talked to students and surveyed students, and they'd be more likely to stay and complete that degree. And since the BAS is completely online, they'll be able to move on and do the BAS while staying gainfully employed full-time in their career choice.
And what's the anticipated enrollment? What are you projecting for the enrollment for this program?
The enrollment.
I'm struggling between the FTEs and the headcount on the chart.
Yes, well, the head count at 15 first year, 30 third year, and 27 fifth year will translate into the FTE of 6, 8, and 10.8 because all of the students will not be attending full time. So some of the students will intend, you know, take 9 credits, some will take 12, some will take 15.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Regent Carter.
A couple questions. So related to this, so would this be the degree you're thinking that people would go into business and industry and CTE type teaching licenses with? Is that the education portion?
That's the education portion is for that. We have, you know, Hug High School down in the Reno area is being repurposed to be a strictly CTE high school. Their anticipated need in a couple of years will be approximately 100 new instructors that will be able to teach CTE classes. And as I said, a lot of the instructors that they hire, they have the industry qualifications, but they can't keep them on more than a year with those because they have to then earn their bachelor's degree. Sure.
So is there like praxis prep and all the other, you know, teaching requirements to get a license incorporated into this?
No, program? It's not for teaching licensure, but there teaches on how to the what do you call that? I'm sorry, I drew a blank here.
Well, but the teach a CTE class or business and industry class,
right?
You have to have that license.
They teach about curriculum development, assessment, classroom best practices, but they don't actually require a practicum to go out and teach because it isn't strictly for that. It could be for corporate training. You know, the students will have, as I said, in a high school where they need the CTE instructors, they just need to have a bachelor's degree.
Correct, but to keep that license to be able to teach, you actually have to have business and industry or CTE license, and that requires praxis exams and passing them or equivalents.
Well, there's yes, within their AA degree, they get the license within their discipline. You know, they are prepared to go out into the workforce and be that certified welder, be that certified
Just ask if you're going to sell it as an education program to go back and look at the state licensing requirements for people that would actually need to be able to teach high school classes, because I think it's missing a couple components that are required by the state of Nevada to maintain and get that teaching license.
It is specifically for the teaching license, and that's something where we work closely with our partnership with UNR, and they have their Teach Nevada program where these people could go and obtain what they need to do that.
I'll say one more time, though, but you're selling as an education program where you're, as part of it, that you're creating a pipeline for high school teachers to teach. They do, in fact, have to have a CTE or business and industry teaching license from Nevada.
That's
a different teaching license than a regular teaching license, and it has certain requirements that are not in this program. So if you're going to sell it as an education program.
No, I mean, where we're focusing on the education is education leadership, the administrative part, the curriculum development, assessment. But I'm saying it could be that first step that, you know, a welder needs to be able to come in and teach classes. And with us at the community colleges, where the focus is, they don't need a teaching license, but they do need a bachelor's degree in the trades.
President Hilgerson.
I have one more question, too, Chair.
Okay, Regent Trachuk, go ahead.
Looking at the, I believe it is page 17 of 20 in the presentation, it shows that for fiscal year 2021, $101,000 of institutional funds are required to be invested, $95,000 the next year, and $102,000 the following year. What's the source of these institutional funds?
It's state funding, but if you notice that if you look at the people who will be instructing, and they're existing professors that are already on the state payroll. So that percentage of their teaching time will be, you know, we would like to hire one full-time and one part-time, but we understand that at this point in time we don't have the funding to do so. But we hope by the time the program wouldn't be up and running until fall 2021, just for the first semester, so full implementation after the end of the 21-22 academic year, we would be requesting for a position at that point in time.
My question is, maybe this isn't correct, or maybe I don't understand it. It says on line item number 2, institution funds ongoing for fiscal year 2021, $101,000. What's the source of the $101,000?
Madam Chair, if I can clarify on behalf of the institution, if you don't mind, for the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic Student Affairs. This, you'll recall, Regent Cherry Chalk, because you've been on this committee for some time, that this form is very different than the form we used 3 or 4 years ago. So first of all, this form aligns directly with the cost form that is reported to the accrediting agencies. And within this, this is not a budget, this is a cost estimate. So where it aligns there on line 2 for institutional funds, the assumption there that we make in the system office is that is out of your state-supported operating budget generally, unless it is otherwise noted as something that is self-supporting. And typically, most of the faculty lines for the community colleges come out of the state-supported operating budget. So as the Vice President indicated, they have existing faculty that are teaching many of these courses now. They're utilizing existing faculty and building off of that and adding courses to create this program. That is very typical for most of the new programs that come forward. We have reviewed this in detail, and we support the way the institution has outlined this. And again, part of the reason that we revised this form is so that they don't have to go back and then retranslate it for accreditors. So we're following the same type of cost information that is reported to the accrediting agencies. I hope that's helpful.
So this isn't an infusion of funds from the institution. This is just using existing faculty members who will have the additional obligation to teach these courses.
That is correct. Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor.
President Hilgerson.
So Karen Hilgerson, for the record, I'd like to go back to Regent Carter's question because I think it's excellent, and I also think it's an excellent piece of advice for us. I do think that as we continue into the real implementation phase of this program, presuming the vote goes positive today, I think we do need to continue to work very closely with Washoe County School District and do what we can to make sure that if some of their current teachers need additional credentialing, that they are also assisting with the appropriate licensure exams and testings. A couple of things I want to say about that is part of this is a response to a need. We're hearing from Washoe County School District that some of their CTE faculty members need more credentialing if they will be continued to allow to teach. They're currently teaching on emergency types of licensures. And so the other thing I wanted to add is this program was really the idea of a small group of faculty who are technical education faculty. And they are very well connected to some of the K-12 educators in our community, and they're responding to a need that they're really excited about. And so, but, you know, when you first introduce a program, there's still a lot more work to be done. And Regent Carter, I think your question is excellent. I think we do need to be very careful in how we message this, because at this point in time, it is not a teacher licensure program. And we're going to count on Washoe County School District to give us advice on that. Thank you.
And it does fill a need in the community because there's no other institution that offers this. And our instructors that went ahead and did bachelor's and master's in CTE education had to go out of state to programs. And it's an online program, so it'll be offered broadly.
Are there any other questions? All right. Thank you for clarifying that. So before I entertain the motion, I want it to just be clearly stated that TMCC is asking for approval of the Bachelor of Applied Science in Career and Technical Education and Leadership. So, and now I will entertain a motion.
Okay, so moved.
I have a motion. Is there a second? I will second it. All those in, are there any questions before we vote? Any comments? Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? I hear none, so the motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will move on to item number 6, WNC program proposal.
Good morning. Kyle Dalby, Vice President of Instruction and Institutional Effectiveness at Western Nevada College.
The first item we have on the agenda is an Associate of Applied Science degree in apprenticeship. This is the final piece in a pathway for our apprentice students. We currently have a skills certificate that stacks into a certificate of achievement. The certificate of achievement will stack into this associate's degree, and then they can actually use that associate's degree for the Bachelor of Applied Science in Organization and Project Management that is up in front of this board from the minute standpoint later on in the meeting. We have developed this by request of our union partners. We expect fairly low numbers because apprentices, as you know, when they get, they go from apprentice to journeyman, they jump right into the workforce. But our idea is to actually get them to continue working through that pathway, the skills certificate being fairly easy for them to attain based on the credit and the work hours they do, the certificate next, the associate degrees where they drop off, and we want to enforce that now while they're in the pathway, while they're fresh in school, because that way they can later in their career really benefit from having the degree and not be thinking about it when they're looking at a career change when they're 50 plus, which is often the case. So with that, we bring that Associate of Applied Science and apprenticeship. Any questions?
Are there any questions or discussion? I see none. So I will entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? I vote aye as well. That motion passes. We will move on to item number 7, which is also WNC.
So again, Kyle Dalpy, Western Nevada College Vice President of Instruction. The second program is an Associate of Applied Science in Health Science, which is an associate degree program for our what we would classify as pre-community health, pre-nursing, students looking at allied health programs that need a degree they can declare to as they work through the prerequisites for those limited entry programs. We believe we will get some pretty good numbers in that because there are some students out there now who are kind of floating and don't have something they can declare, which is why the sheet with the enrollments on it has some decent numbers in there. There are quite a bit of current students who will declare this as they move in. And then for some reason, if they don't get into the nursing program, if they don't get into paramedic allied health programs, they will be able to continue in this allied health program. Health science program, AAS, to complete a degree and then possibly move on to another area, whatever their interest may be. Similar to other schools that have this, I believe we might be the only community college that does not have a program like this at this time.
Okay. Are there any questions or any discussion? All right. I will entertain a motion.
So moved.
So moved.
All right. So we have a motion from Regent Lieberman and a second from Regent Trachak. Thank you. Any further comments or discussion? Yes, Regent Carter.
Not necessarily related to this specific item, but just I love when there's industry people that have signed off and endorsed a program. And I noticed that in some of our proposals, there's some and some of them that there aren't. That's always a great thing in my view, if just future going forward, TMCC and WNC.
Thank you for that. If there are no further questions or comments, I will entertain a motion for item number 7.
Thank you, added motion.
Oh, we already have.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. All right, then we will vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? I vote aye as well. The motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we will go to Vice Chancellor Abba for item number 8.
Thank you for the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. I won't go through the reference material in great detail because you're used to this format. I just want to highlight a couple of items and where we're at and what we've accomplished since you were last here. First of all, we are on target to bring you an action plan, to bring this board an action plan in September. At the September meeting, and that will then allow the institutions the academic year 2021 to put into place mechanics of the action plan so that they will be ready for full scale in fall 21 as this board directed. One thing that we realized in the last several months was kind of the piecemeal approach that we were taking was creating its own challenges as we were primarily operating out of the small budget I had for academic and student affairs and hiring a consultant to help us with this work. So she was primarily there for organizing the meetings and helping us with certain materials. And quite frankly, as we went through this work, we very quickly realized that absent someone on the ground who really understands the necessity of the kind of support that the system office needs to provide, we didn't have that. And so it was at that point we had known about the Nevada Energy money and we had applied for the funding from Strong Start to Finish and ECMC that we spoke with the chancellor and we created a position at the system level that is now part-time, the assistant vice chancellor for student success and the director of co-requisite implementation, James McCoy. James, if you could please stand. Not that anyone in this room doesn't know who you are, but I would like to give him a round of applause because I can't do this work without him. And I wish that President Z was here because I owe him a debt of gratitude. And if I ever have another child, I will name my child after President Z because that's how important James' role will be in this. The future of his position will, of course, be contingent, and I have to be honest with this, on the two grants that we have applied for. And from that, just yesterday, Theo and I spent 2 days in Miami at the Strong Start to Finish conference, which was primarily dedicated to states that have either done full-scale implementation or they're on the way to that in terms of full-scale implementation for COREC. Just a little quick background. Strong Start to Finish is primarily supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Ascendium, and the Kretzky Foundation. And leaving Miami yesterday, outside of being exhausted and somewhat exhilarated, I was gratified by the fact that if you look at the type of work that's happening in other states, everything that we are struggling with in terms of implementation, someone has been there before us. I think at one point I said to Theo yesterday, you know, if I had gone to this conference 9 months ago, I think we would be in a very different place today. Mostly I would feel better about it because a lot of the things that we've had to figure out in the last 6 months, someone has already figured out before us. But again, the challenge with having that consultant on a very limited basis was that we didn't have all the knowledge that we needed in terms of where were the hiccups in other states. And of course, the other challenge is that in many respects, Nevada is unique because of the type of system that we are versus states. I mean, you can't compare us to Georgia or Florida, states that have done this on a full-scale level that Nevada doesn't really compare to. But I think when there was one particular breakout session that I wanted to mention because what it did was it provided a toolkit for system leadership. And it broke that toolkit out into certain phases. And there were two pieces that I want to draw to your attention because they're exactly the things that we are struggling with today. And under establishing structures to drive implementation, item number one is provide financial resources to individual institutions to support their local implementation efforts. As you know, at the last meeting, we reported on the fact that we realized this cannot be an unfunded mandate, which is why we went to why the chancellor graciously, once we got the Nevada Energy incentive payment, this board said, okay, let's use this to support this work. But in addition to that, the two grants. I am realizing more and more how critical those dollars are. And states that are doing this and doing this job well, they have that support. The challenge is those are typically states where the risk is relatively low because they have a proven track record because they have more resources than we do. And I think that's the part where when I got on the plane leaving Miami, I was biting my fingernails because the importance of getting these grants, it's absolutely critical to what we're doing. And I will say that Theo and I, because we separated a lot during this event, we had more people come up to us individually and say, Nevada is really primed for this work. The challenge was those aren't the people that are on the boards for Bill and Melinda Gates and Ascension and the Kresge Foundation that are making the decisions for funding. So it all comes down to that document that we wrote and making sure that they understand how primed we are. But the piece that makes us so critically primed, it's because of this board, because this board adopted the policy. That is the absolute key piece that they're looking for. for is policy or legislation that pushes this work forward. And of course, then they want to see the infrastructure behind that, which is what we're trying to provide from the system office. The second piece that we're struggling with now and why James is so critical is it says that the system office should be clarifying the appropriate balance between fidelity to common implementation features and needed institutional flexibility. So what that means is we know that there will be key elements in the action plan, like how will institutions handle placement, pathways, pedagogy, and curriculum. And we are now trying to decide those areas where we want the institution to have commonality across the system versus areas where there can be difference between the institutions in terms of implementation. And saying that out loud seems simple in and of itself, but those are detailed conversations, and the challenge is we've got to make sure that we have the funding resources to bring the institutions together for those discussions. And again, it goes back to the funding from those grants. So I'm asking everyone to go home tonight and light candles and pray that we get these two grants. Otherwise, I'll be having a very difficult conversation with the chancellor and chair of the board in terms of the ability to progress this work on the aggressive timeline that we have in place now. The last thing I wanted to mention was the presentation before the Legislative Committee on Education that was on February 20th. The chancellor kicked that off, and we provided basic information on what is COREC, how are we going to do it, and when are we going to do it by. And I think the committee was very grateful and incredibly supportive of this work. And the one key takeaway, I think, for many committee members was understanding the difference between a traditional prereq remedial pathway and co-requisite support. We're not eliminating remediation. We're changing the way, we're changing the culture. And I would describe them, particularly Senator Maggie Carlton, who's part of the money committees, as extremely supportive. So we were very happy with that outcome as they now understand this work. And that will lend into your budget conversation tomorrow with that enhancement request for support for co-requisite implementation. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Theo, and he's going to add a few pieces to this.
Excellent. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to provide an update. My name is Theo Meek. I'm the NSHE research scholar. I just want to add two more thoughts onto our attendance at the Strong Start to Finish convening yesterday. One in that Nevada, what I was getting and from what colleagues from across other states and systems of higher education had reaffirmed to us was that whereas Nevada might have started to be lagging in this work, by the extremely comprehensive board policy that was passed, we are immensely farther ahead than where a lot of other states and systems. The vice chancellor of the SUNY system came up to me yesterday and said, I wish we could have done an implementation how Nevada did, because she didn't feel like she had the political capital to be able to advance this work across all of the SUNY system, whereas we were able to accomplish that. So we're receiving high accolades, not only from other state systems, but also from intermediaries such as the Dana Center, the Carnegie Math Foundations out of West Ed, both of which came up to me yesterday and gave high praises and also put in good words for us for Strong Start to Finish, because they are exceptionally excited about the work. So it was reassuring to hear, you know, of course, Crystal and I and James believe so strongly in this work, but it was wonderful to hear that we are being recognized across the nation for a really, really robust, comprehensive, and aggressive implementation of COREC. To give everyone an update on what's next with co-requisite, the NSHE co-requisite implementation task force, James has been putting in triple overtime in his 20 hours a week as he is right now in meeting with many of our math faculty, English faculty, and administrator groups. We have some meetings set up next week with math and English faculty individually to talk very, very specifically about pathways and placement to make sure that we have commonality across the system. Everyone from the administrator groups and the math and English groups are in common agreement that students need to have a consistent experience when they enter any one of the NSHE's higher education systems. Now we're just figuring out how do we do that. So our meeting next week will have a directed emphasis on consistent pathways, consistent placement for all of our students. Additionally, we have a meeting coming up with an administrator group at DRI next Friday as well. Our administrators are talking very, very in-depth about how do we, what's the teeth in this? How do we enforce enrollment, both from the initial enrollment and the ensuring that students maintain enrollment in the course. So, you know, the advisor doesn't enroll them in the course and the student turns around and drops it. So we're having very, very in-depth conversations about how to make that happen. And we're working through at least three main technical challenges. Additionally, we have our next and third co-requisite implementation task force meeting on April 3rd at UNLV, which we will send, Vice Chancellor Abba will send you all an invite out to attend. And we would like to thank at UNLV in advance. Laurel Pritchard in particular has been a wonderful, wonderful host to us in both our meetings that have happened very recently and at the UNLV meeting. After that, we are looking forward to visiting James McCoy, Vice Chancellor Abba, and myself will be visiting many of the institutions to get a more in-depth conversation going with the institutional officers and make sure that each of the institutions feel supported in this work by system administration. That's my report. Are there any questions?
Are there any questions or comments? I have just a couple comments. One is I want to thank you, Vice Chancellor Abba, for repeating that this cannot be an unfunded mandate to our institutions. I remember speaking out loudly about that before. And so thank you for bringing it up again. And then my question in regard to that is when do you anticipate hearing on the grants, please?
Good question. We were supposed to hear on February 28th from Strong Start to Finish, but their board is actually meeting now, so we expect to hear from them next week. On ECMC, which is actually the bigger grant of $750,000, that'll be sometime in April. And by the way, so the way this is working in terms of James's position is that he is part-time now, as Theo indicated, at 20 hours per week, but once we secure that funding, he would be full-time starting on May 1.
Thank you. Any other comments? Thank you for the report. Okay, we will move on to item number 9, Complete College America Pathways. Thanks for showing up so much today, James.
You bet. Good morning, James McCoy for the record, Associate Vice President for Academic Affairs at CSN. We have had this conversation around what Complete College America has done for us as a Southern Nevada consortium between Nevada State College and College of Southern Nevada and UNLV a couple of times now in this committee. And we really appreciate the support that each of you have given to this work. What it has done is allowed us with some significant technical assistance dollars, a tune of about $450,000 from Complete College America as funded through the ECMC Foundation. It has given us the technical assistance to be able to proactively work as a Southern Nevada region around the board's goals, student success, closing achievement gaps, and in many ways, a lot of the research pieces as well. And so today, it's our pleasure to share with you sort of 1 year later where each of our institutions are at with our implementation efforts surrounding the Metro Momentum Pathways work. Just as a quick primer and a quick review, up on the screen here, you'll see the major tenets of the Pathways work as prescribed by Complete College America and as put forth into best practice across this country. As you know, the importance of proactive advising at regular intervals with a proper student-to-counselor advisor ratios is critical in this work. That leads off the work with advisors and advising. The 15 to Finish campaign, Finish in Two, on-time graduation, proper credit accumulation, those sorts of things. This board adopted a beautiful campaign around 15 to Finish a number of years ago under the direction of Vice Chancellor Abba, and it is cooking with steam now as we begin further development around our academic mapping. Lots of conversations around pathways regarding co-requisite math and English remediation reform. And we know what the board graciously did in looking at students first in this space, and our institutions are cooking with gas along these lines as well. So as you begin to see what's happening at UNLV and Nevada State College and CSN around this Metro Momentum Pathways work, you're going to see the student success plan tactics that were presented to the board about a year ago from each of these institutions come to light. Real tangible things. I'm really proud of that. And there's one additional component before I turn it over to my colleague at UNLV, Dr. Pritchard. And that is, this work has been done with two major lenses. One, around student equity, closing those achievement gaps, and two, around student basic need. And those student basic needs have been sort of fundamentally rallied around homelessness, food insecurity, transportation challenges, and child care. So you'll see some of that work come out to play in full implementation in our report today. So we've got about 30 minutes or so left, and what we'll do is each of us will take a few minutes to describe where NSC, UNLV, and CSN are at in this work, and then by all means, please ask questions as we go. Thank you. I'd like to introduce Dr. Pritchard from UNLV.
Thank you, James. Laurel Pritchard, for the record, Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education at UNLV. Oh, wrong way. So I'll just be working through each of the game changer strategies that James presented. We'll start with Momentum Year. At UNLV, our Momentum Year efforts begin with an improved onboarding experience for our new students through new student orientation. We've moved a lot of key information that used to be presented in the on-campus orientation to online modules that students can now complete before they arrive on campus for orientation. By moving this basic but very important information to online modules, we free up time during the on-campus orientation for students to focus on engagement, belonging, and the UNLV academic experience. We also free up more time for students to engage in meaningful conversations with their academic advisors about planning a schedule that allows them to make significant progress in their area of study during the first year. We've also made a significant investment with the board's support in first year proactive advising. We're now in the process of onboarding the last two of 11 new first year advisors, so we have an update since these slides were submitted. These advisors will have assigned caseloads of first-year students, and they'll be expected to touch those students at key times during the academic year to provide prioritized and timely interventions to support students who appear to be falling off their path to success. To enhance our proactive advising plan, we've also made some updates to the technology platform that we use for academic advising, powered by EAB Navigate. In that platform, we've updated our success marker courses. These courses have been found to be highly predictive of successful graduation in particular majors. So if a student doesn't register for one of those courses or doesn't pass one of those courses, their advisor will know about it and can reach out to the student to make sure that they get back on a path to success. We've been using the platform for several years now for early alerts for our 100 and 200 level classes. But this year, for the first time, we'll be pairing the early alerts with case management. What this means for our students is that for a student who receives alerts in multiple courses, a case will be opened. That case will be assigned to a specific advisor who's expected to then close the case by reaching out to the student, making referrals to appropriate support services on campus, and then following up with the student to make sure that they've accessed those services. Another key game changer recommended by Complete College America are major maps. We'll be embarking on this process very soon, in partnership between academic advising, career services, and workforce development at UNLV. So currently, we do provide students with major-specific information about the courses they should be taking each year, the co-curricular experiences they should be exploring, and the career options they can prepare for. But all of this information lives in different documents or different web pages. By creating these experiential major maps, we can bring all of that information into a single document that allows students to make informed major choices and then follow a clear path from year to year to prepare themselves for success and graduation. We're starting the process of developing these experiential major maps next week in collaboration with our EAB Academic Affairs Research Consultant. As you just heard from Theo Meek and Crystal Abba, co-requisite support has been a major focus of all of the institution's work over the past year. At UNLV, we piloted 6 sections of math, 2 each, of Math 120, 124, and 126, each with a 2-credit co-requisite support component. These sections served 211 students who would have otherwise enrolled in Math 95 or Math 96. Historically, only about 55% of UNLV students who started in Math 95 or Math 96 passed a college-level math course within the first year. However, in our co-requisite pilot sections, we found that 68% of those students passed the college-level course in the first semester. This is in comparison to a 70% pass rate for the standard versions of Math 120, 124, and 126 in the same semester. So we're very encouraged by these initial pilot results, but we also understand that we have significant work to do in that area. We plan to pilot a similar version of co-requisite English next academic year, and we continue to work with the NSHE Implementation Task Force to prepare for a full-scale launch of co-requisite support in fall 2021. The final component of the Metro Momentum Pathways project involves social support for students to address those non-academic needs that can potentially pull them off of their academic path. At the December board meeting, you heard from Laura Obrist, and she's Foster Youth Ambassador, about system-wide efforts to implement fee waivers for former foster youth. At that time, NSHE submitted a grant to the Walter S. Johnson Foundation to build infrastructure to support foster youth beyond the fee waivers. At that time, UNLV was also fortunate enough to have the opportunity to submit a parallel grant. I am extremely pleased to report that that grant was funded, and it will allow us to establish a program coordinator position to address the summer and winter break housing needs of our former foster youth, and to expand some of our existing basic needs services on campus. These services include our basic needs closet, which provides clothing, bedding, toiletries, and non-perishable food items to students in need. The grant will also allow us to add to the emergency, the Intersection CARES Emergency Fund. This fund is available to help students with financial hardships that arise due to emergency, accidents, or major unforeseen expenses. We're confident that through this grant and our continued work to meet our students' basic needs, that our most vulnerable students will be able to focus on their academic goals because their basic needs are met. With that, I'm happy to take any questions.
I have just one question about that. I'm assuming those basic social support needs are, we're not just talking about our foster students.
That is correct. Okay. So those basic needs supports, like the basic needs closet and the Intersection CARES Emergency Fund, are available to all of our students, but we will be able to use a portion of this grant to expand those services.
Thank you, because that's my understanding, that all of our institutions have students with those basic needs. And so I'm happy to hear that. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Regent Perkins. Oh, I took care of that question. Okay. Thank you. Regent Carter?
Just real quick, I love the idea of the academic maps. I would just make sure that you keep some of the student government involved as well, so they can help you figure out exactly what they would like to see on there, in addition to what the university would like to see on there.
Yes, thank you for that suggestion.
Are there any other questions or comments? Thank you.
Okay. And with that, I'll introduce my colleague, Tony Shinta, Executive Vice Provost at Nevada State College.
Good morning. Tony Shinta, Executive Vice Provost, Nevada State College, for the record. And let's see. Okay, so for my update, I'm going to walk through a few of the different game changers that we've implemented and our progress and our next steps for each. But before I jump into that, I wanted to give you a little insight into the framework through which we approach this work, because that framework really is maybe as important as the work itself, and it kind of infiltrates everything we do where we're able to do it. So it's not always this clean with the circle. Sometimes the arrows are pointing in seven different directions, but the elements are in place. So generally, we're looking at trying to incorporate evidence-based practice, and then we take those evidence-based practice and we bolster their implementation through policy. Often that policy is coming directly from the board to give teeth to what we are trying to do. And then we assess. You may have seen or heard about our dashboards. I certainly will talk about them if I get you cornered for any second. And we assess how it's going. And then from there, and this is a really important component, we do what we can to tailor our initiatives to our student population. So a best practice that works anywhere is going to work on our campus. It's going to work at UNLV or CSN. But a best practice that is tailored even further to the unique needs of our students is going to work even better. And that's what we operate from. So a good example of this is 15 to finish. So with 15 to finish, we've seen some progress in credit accumulation among incoming freshmen. So you see that there are gains in 15 credits in the first fall. This is among all freshmen, not just IPEDS, and then also 30 credits in the first year. So we see that progress, and it's partly a function of, well, we have a best practice. And then we are using administrative enrollment and holds and other things to try and put some teeth behind how we implement that practice. And then we are assessing. We're seeing the results that you have right here in front of you. And then from those results, we're trying to figure out how can we improve what we are doing based on what we are seeing. As you can see, I'm proud of the gains we've made, but we're still not there yet. Right. Even in the most recent count on record, we have 38% of students with 15 credits in the first fall, 27% of students with 30 credits in the first year. And one of the things we're recognizing as far as next steps and how we can tweak this is that, you know, 15 credits in a semester isn't necessarily an easy fit for our students, especially with 100% commuter campus. So one of the focuses is, well, can we do 30 credits in a year? Is that more amenable to our student population? Because it doesn't take very fancy math to know 15 credits in each semester is the same as getting 30 credits in a year. And that's where some of our efforts going forward will align. And we've seen in our data, we've done some analyses where we've seen even if a student can get 26 credits in their first year, if they can accumulate that much, whole first year, spring, summer, fall, their likelihood of graduating is significantly higher than if that doesn't happen. Where we need help and where the students need help is figuring out a game plan for how they can pay for courses in the summer, right? So that they have funds remaining, that they're planning out to do it. But if they can do that, they're going to be more likely to be successful. That's the tailoring that I'm talking about. Math pathways and co-rec support. I won't talk about every initiative in here, but we've adopted the co-rec model. We've overhauled our curriculum in our fundamental gateway math. EdReady, really, the idea behind EdReady is something you'll hear from CCA and something we've talked about and Theo's talked about is that we're trying to ensure, even before any of this work started, we were trying to ensure that our students are not underplaced. It's one thing to be underprepared, but it's an entirely different thing to be underplaced. And so EdReady gives those students an opportunity who are maybe placed via standardized tests into remediation to improve their placement into college-level math. The consequence of this, again, the assessment, we have seen significant gains in both math and English in the percentage of students who are completing their gateway course requirements, their core requirements in the first year. And we've also seen a pretty significant decline in DFWI rates in Math 120 and 120E, which are the de facto gateway math courses taken by non-science majors. And I do like to highlight, you know, you see that red bar right there where we're declining and then we jump back up in 2017. That, we think, is a consequence of that 72% enrollment growth in freshmen. So it was great to have that degree of growth, but we also struggled. You know, we struggled, and we realized that. And then we had interesting conversations. One of my math colleagues is here. In that budget cycle, we actually had a situation where the provost office is trying to persuade the math faculty that you need more faculty rather than the other way around. But it was a consequence of realizing what happened. And as you can see, our DFWI rates again dropped 2 years later. So next steps are pretty straightforward here. We need to continue the implementation of the new policy. And we need to conduct a summer planning institute. In our data, what we see, 120E is working pretty well already. It's a self-selected population student, but it's working pretty well. But 126E, the stretch version of the science-based math, needs a lot of work, and so that's where we're going to direct our attention in our next effort. Proactive advising. We adopted mandatory advising for incoming freshmen a while ago, and then more recently in the last couple years, we introduced mandatory advising for all incoming students. We've greatly expanded our advising capacity from 3 advisors to 8 plus 1 on a grant. One of the newest developments is just in, I think in June of this past year, we got the Starfish platform, and by fall, we had implemented a e-alert system whereby faculty could send their alerts to advisors. Advisors can reach out to the students and provide the kind of support or direction to support that they need. We call that the Scorpion Success Network, as you see up there. And if you look at what that did, it's a modest start. This is why we assess. So decent level of access for the Scorpion Success e-alert network among faculty and staff and students. And we did have 254 e-alerts. That's a 400% increase, but the reason why 254 is in big letters, because that's where my focus is. 400% sounds great, but 254 isn't enough. So when we look at something like this, one of the first things I said to the advising team is, all right, great job. I'm happy that you got this off the ground so quickly. This is something our students need. But how do we expand the scope of this e-alert effort to more students? How do we do that? And that's what we'll work on, is trying to reach more students and getting more students to respond. You know, one of the hidden elements of this is just because you have e-alert and you have an advisor reaching out to a student doesn't mean that student necessarily is going to capitalize on that opportunity. In this first effort, about 60% of students actually responded to the advisor inquiry. We want to get that number up. How can we do that? How can we get more students to respond to our efforts to help them? And we'll implement other efforts, such as a student absence notification system, which is oriented around the idea that for a lot of students, if something goes awry even in the first couple weeks, it may be too late to get them back. That's just the reality. And what are some of the signals that something is going awry? Well, not being in class is one of the big signals. So we're going to try to further capitalize on that knowledge and do something to ameliorate it. Social supports. We founded a care team to help students who were struggling with a variety of issues several years ago. And we've expanded the scope of what care team does. Care team is also part of the Scorpion Success Network, where they can get referrals to help students in need. And we also have gone from having no on-campus counseling support for students. And actually, it was a consequence, and I think this is really cool, a consequence of a research study that students did in conjunction with faculty that recommended on-campus counseling and really was like the impetus to make that leap. So a couple years ago, we introduced on-campus counseling. I think it was 1 day a week. Then we expanded to 2 days a week. Then more recently, we expanded it to 4 days a week because we saw that there was a demand and we were helping students, but we needed to increase our capacity. And, of course, we have a food pantry that's burgeoning and growing and getting off the ground. Next steps, two of those next steps you could ignore because they kind of hitchhiked from the other slide. I don't know how that happened. But the first one is just additional resource investments. into this area. So one of the things in our budget request as an actual bona fide counselor of our own that could come on board in conjunction with the advent of our residence halls that would complement what is happening with the on-campus counseling that we contract out to All About You services. And so investments of that nature are being taken into account in our strategic planning and, you know, where we're investing our resources. Finally, overall next step. So I'm proud of what the team has done and what the campus has done. I'm proud of seeing the metrics trend in the right direction in terms of student success. That's encouraging. But there's also areas where we just haven't done nearly enough. So with degree pathways, we're making that effort. But we know, I've probably said this to this group before, when we survey students about almost every facet of Nevada State College, we do get a lot of high marks, which is encouraging. But we often get our lowest marks in items that relate to I can get the classes I need when I need them. Part of that is a function of being a small campus. It's not easy to offer a huge constellation of classes at different times of day. But part of it is about being more strategic in how we offer classes and when we offer them. You know, where we can, we've leveraged mandates and recommendations from the board. So we ran a retreat this past fall that was oriented around this idea of decentralizing and getting some of the departments to examine student success data. And so we brought the department heads together to examine student success data, and we did it in looking at high DFWI rates in their majors and course or degree pathway bottlenecks. And we got some really good data. Now the key is to implement what we've learned to make changes as a consequence of that effort. And then finally, there's continued work we can do on the Momentum Year game changer. One very salient example is undecided students. You know, if you're an undecided, you're an undeclared student, you necessarily might not have very much momentum because you're not even sure what you want to do. And when we look at that population, if you categorize that as a major cohort, in some years it's our second biggest major behind pre-nursing, but it's our lowest retention rate among undecided. So that tells us right there, that's a tremendous opportunity to try and help those students. And so we'll do some planning and programming around how we can ameliorate that situation. So that's it. I know it was quick, but in the interest of time, I wanted to get through this. So any questions for me?
I don't see any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we're nearing the end of our update on the Metro Momentum Pathways work. I want to give a brief update on where we've been at and where we're headed next at CSN along these lines. I've had the opportunity plenty of times within the ARSA committee to share much of our work around pathways. This work for CSN began in 2012. So today I will reserve my comments for just what has occurred as a result of the last year or year and a half related to this particular grant. So we are in our third reiteration of academic maps. This is the course-by-course sequencing, much like we've just heard from UNLV and CSN. Our crux right now is to ensure that our academic maps are aligned for transfer so that it is truly a 2+2 academic map. The freshman and the sophomore year at CSN ought to mirror the freshman and sophomore year experience at our four-year institutions where our students are transferring. So that's where we're at the moment. We've also done a lot of work with our academic maps around what Tony just referred to as the purpose first year, the areas of study, the meta majors, and I'll describe more about that in just a moment. We've done a significant amount of lift around our proactive career and academic advising orientation. This is such a critical component, and I'm going to share with you some data in just a moment to show you why or to remind you why, but what we feel is that based on our data at CSN at least, every student's undecided, and we say that because our degree declaration changes are upwards on average of 3 times for a two-year degree. So if we can't get them with purpose, and I mean intentional purpose first, at the front door of admissions, they're going to trek down a pathway, in many cases, in vain. And as a result of that, increase credits, pay a lot more money for it, lose the financial aid opportunities, the momentum goes there, and as a result, SAP kicks in. So we're doing a lot of work around proactive advising, career and academic orientation. Obviously, we adopted a Finish in 2 campaign. We believe in credit momentum at CSN. Well, obviously, that's the game changer to get us to on-time degree completion. But when we look at our data at CSN, our students on average are not 15 credits, unfortunately. No matter how hard we push, we get that student who's taking 9 credits to get to 12. We get the student who's taking 12 credits to get to 15, no doubt. But getting a student who is on average taking 1 class or 3 credits at a time to 15, with the barriers that they have in front of them around childcare, around parenting, around 2 or 3 jobs, in many cases full-time jobs, this becomes a very barrier. So we've got to restructure the way we deliver education structurally at CSN. And what that has translated to is really reevaluating the way in which we schedule courses in the context of short term. Oddly enough, particularly for returning adults, we found that students are able to engage in 30 credits of accumulation over a course of a year by taking 6 credits at a time, 8 weeks, 8 weeks, 8 weeks, 8 weeks, 2, 2, 2, 2. And over the course of that year, they've accumulated the 30 credits. Therefore, they're on time to graduation. And what that means then is the student has just 2 final exams to deal with at any given time, 2 professors' syllabi to deal with at any given time. And so as life gets in the way, particularly for our returning adult learners, the likelihood for their whole academic career at 15-credit thresholds is not as derailed. So a lot of great work in that regard. Like NSC, we have adopted Starfish, the Hobson's product. It's our CRM that sits on top of our student information system. So the frequency of early alerts, the triaging of early alerts, the proactivity around early alerts is cooking with gas at CSN. And having this technology in place by no means is a silver bullet. But by having the policy and infrastructure and campus culture around student success, where then technology can help us funnel to scale things like early alert technology, we feel it really has been a benefit. We've talked a lot about co-requisite math and English. Just like the other institutions, our pilots have been underway for a couple of years now. We look forward to further scaling those pilots this fall, and we anticipate full implementation in 2021. A lot of work around scaling up dual enrollment. And I mentioned this in the context of this Pathways work because it is important that we capture our high school students who are going to be attending CSN or one of our sister institutions with a Pathways mentality while they're in their dual enrollment experience. In other words, we don't want to sprinkle a plethora of courses in the dual enrollment context without it being part of a contextualized pathway. We want to be able to identify who our STEM students are, who our liberal arts students are, who our business students are, while they're juniors or even earlier in high school. So when they engage in their dual enrollment, the courses that they take while in high school are for right. They're going to continue along that pathway upon matriculation into the 4-year or 2-year institution. And finally, and I'll spend the bulk of the rest of my time talking about this, this has been the real game changer for us since we've last spoke, and that's around our purpose-first areas of study approach. I've had the pleasure in my role as a Complete College America Fellow to travel the country and help other institutions, states, and systems with their purpose-first work. And this really gets at this sort of metaphor that I'll share with you now, this analogy. When you go to a shopping mall or you walk into a fitness store and you need to buy a pair of tennis shoes, there's a wall of tennis shoes, and oftentimes we're debilitated by choice. Which shoe am I going to buy? So I try them on, and then I try the next pair on, and I try the next pair on until I find just the one that fits. The point is that at the front door of buying tennis shoes, I have to try some things on. I have to get acquainted with my opportunities that are on that wall. Well, in loose analogy, it's the same thing in regarding the purpose first for academic pathways and ultimate, the finish line. What do I want it to be when I grow up? What do I want to do with my career? Imagine this on an application admissions form. We ask a student for their name. We ask a student for their birthday, some other critical information. Then they get to that magic box where we ask the student what they want to be when they grow up. And we give them a drop-down list of nearly, or in fact, over 100 options. This is at the time of admission where they haven't had proactive advising. If they had career academic sort of aptitude testing in high school, it's a blessing, but many have not. In fact, most have not. For our returning adults who are looking to get retooled, they certainly haven't had career aptitude assessment to the scale that we'd like them to, because we want them to have this choice purposefully about what pathway they're going to get on. And so I want to share with you for the bulk of my time what the Purpose First implementation plan has looked like at CSN. We're really proud of this. In fact, I want you to also know that the nation is proud of this work as well, as it is being replicated in states like Wisconsin today. So let's talk about Purpose First. Here's what the data showed us. On average, the number of credits that students are earning for a 60-credit associate degree at CSN was 95.5. You know this data. The excess credit fee policy was put into place, perhaps in part due to this kind of data. But that's not good, obviously, for a myriad of reasons. The more students accumulate credits, the more likely it is they're never going to earn the credit, the degree that they've sought out to earn. The average time to complete a two-year associate's degree at CSN is 4.5 years. Part of that is based on the part-time nature. But what do we know about part-time students? The likelihood for graduation is in the single digits. The average number of major declaration changes at CSN students who are degree-seeking is 3 times for a two-year degree. That's where I come from the premise that our students are probably many, in fact, if not most, all really undecided at the front door of admission. So we need to meet students where they are, and we need to think about ways in which we can restructure the first year, restructure the momentum year, as it's coined, restructure what that front door of engagement on an admissions application and that entire matriculation funnel all the way through into the second year of their academic work. So here's some of the challenges that we had to overcome when we began to parse out this data. The accumulation of excess credits was ridiculous. The time to degree is incredibly long. There are too many major changes. As a result, low graduation rates are occurring. Excessive student debt is obviously a byproduct of that. And ultimately, our students were debilitated by choice. Interestingly enough, when we looked at the actual disaggregation of our major declarations, undecided was a number one option in the early days. And why do you suppose that was? It was the first one listed in the list of 100. Guess what the second one was? Business. Follow the alphabet down, you can start to see some correlations. And so this has really driven the national dialogue and now our regional dialogue here in Nevada around this work for Purpose First. It's the Purpose First momentum year. It starts out, as I mentioned, in the application experience. We're not asking students to self-declare into one of 100-plus options anymore. We're asking a student to engage with purpose around a career aptitude assessment, to think about the end in mind. What does the finish line look like for me? What do I want to be when I grow up? After that is determined, and I'll share with you some visuals on how that has helped, our students then have a mandatory hold on enrollment. This was a scary thing for CSN. Put an enrollment hold on enrollment before enrollment actually, before the first semester begins. It could be a crisis from an enrollment management standpoint. But what we found was we put that enrollment hold in place to provoke very purposeful, triaged, mandatory experiences before they enroll in their first semester. Obviously required placement. And the co-rec experience is playing out in that. Required orientation for every student who's seeking a degree or certificate from CSN. Not a pilot project any longer, every student. And required academic and career advising before they engage in their first semester of selecting their courses. Our data in this, and I've shared this data with the ARSA committee before, has been incredible in a myriad of metrics, not the least of which is on-time completion. We've also engaged in a new proactive advising model. So not only are our students engaging at the front door of admission, a required advising experience where there is aptitude testing and career assessments and academic map planning, but also at every 15 credit of accumulation interval, our students will be required to see an advisor. That's a tough thing. Again, hold on enrollment. I've earned 15 credits. It's now time for my opportunity to go see my advisor, make sure I'm on track, check in on those early alerts that I've perhaps received in that first part of the semester. And here's the critical crunch. We can't allow a student to stay within an area of study because it's not really a major. There's some things behind the scenes I can share with you, but there's a plethora of business opportunities. And so it's during that first advising session after a student has completed 15 credits where a student must actually then, with intentionality, select their actual major. And you'll see by this visual up on the screen, those milestone advising visits, that proactive advising occurs then again at 30 credits and at 45 credits. And we are really, really proud of our advising and counseling team at CSN because they have created learning outcomes associated with every one of these advising sessions. Every one of those sessions has intentionality. It's proactive. And we're excited to see how that pans out. This also is going to be in help us with our 350-to-1 advisor to student ratio. So again, in that first semester, first experience advising session, it's the purpose first advising. They're declaring their area of study or their major if they're ready for their major. If they're not, they're being reaffirmed in their selection of their area of study. They're assigned an academic advisor based on their area of study within 2 weeks of the start of the academic term. And they create that academic plan with the academic advisor as it relates to the academic maps that have already been prescribed by our faculty. So what did this look like from a tangible standpoint? The admissions application needed to be redesigned. The areas of study webpage, the funnel management of getting students from the external facing CSN webpage through the process of self-discovery with career assessment and career aptitude testing and proper informed choice around their area of study needed to occur. That takes place on the web. General education curricular alignment needed to happen. It was not enough to take the 100-plus majors and clump them into similar clusters like health science or business or hospitality and culinary, because the curriculum needed to be aligned within the first 15 credits. So for that student who's going to select health sciences, for example, as their area of study, they needed to be able to take their first semester of courses, their first 15 credits, not in vain. In other words, every major within the health sciences field in that area of study needed to have the same first 15 credits. Does that make sense? So imagine that curricular lift and the rallying that had occurred among our faculty and advising and counseling staff over a period of just over a year. It's a very major project, and I'm very proud of the work that they did there. The academic maps, therefore, are now by areas of study and by major. Career interest aptitude assessment is happening at admissions and replicated again during the first advising session. They declare their area of study at time of admissions. They confirm that area of study during the first advising session. And they can't swirl in an area of study. They must, with a hold, declare their actual major before they've accumulated 15 credits. A lot of policy work went into place on this. Our Faculty Senate committees led this work around the declaration of major. No longer will we allow a student to swirl within more than one major without intentionality. No longer will we allow a student to change their major without conversation about the implications on financial aid or their veterans benefits, for example. So this purpose-first policy around declaration of major is the tenet, is the guts, is the roots of all of this work for our purpose-first approach. So where did we end up? Here's a snapshot from our CSN webpage. This is the webpage where our new soon-to-be students will interface. These are the 11 areas of study. Each of these areas of study have a plethora, a cluster, if you will, of majors. We didn't do away with most of the majors, as long as they had fidelity. But we clustered them underneath each one of these 11. So now a student needs to declare which of the 11 they're going to pursue at the time of admissions. Again, on our CSN website, they're introduced to all 11. They click on one. For the purpose of this snapshot, I clicked on biological and physical sciences. It says it leads to careers in biology and chemistry, physics, astronomy. You can follow along. Now they're interested. I want to explore some more. Here's what they get. This is a snapshot of the humanities and communication page. They get more exposure to what a major within the humanities and communication space will look like. We ask them, do you like things like telling stories, learning new languages, helping people bridge cultural differences, meeting new people? If so, take a look at these careers. You see, we're flipping the script. We're not asking a student to self-select into a major. We're asking a student to tell us what they're thinking about for their career, and then let us do our job to align the proper academic major to that finish line, to that career. As they click further into this experience, they can begin to investigate all the careers that are sort of embedded within those areas of with that particular area of study. And further, they can see the first line of defense. They can see that pathway, that academic map, what those associate degrees and or bachelor's degrees and or certificates look like to get them on the pathway to that career. Now, this is a really exciting part for me. We're able to make sure that students are making informed choices, not only on their area of study, but their actual career field. So as the student is continuing to explore more, they're now in the public relations specialist drill down. They think they want to be a PR guy or gal. Now we're giving them actual real-time information, or as close to real-time as possible, around the hourly rate of pay in the region, around the salary that's expected within the region for a PR specialist, what the current employment outlook looks like, and what the growth factor is in that particular industry sector for public relations in this context. We pull all this information in from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And then, of course, we funnel them right into the academic pathway that will get them there. So communication is critical in this work. We developed this next short vignette I want to share with you. It's a very short video. This is what our students will experience when they're trying to self-select in their area of study. This was funded in part by the Lumina Talent Hub grant that CSN and the city got just about a year or so ago. So I hope you enjoy.
Hey, Gabby, are you applying?
Oh, hey, Marcus. Yeah, I just spoke with an academic advisor to discuss my options.
There are so many choices, I'm not sure where to begin.
Well, let me help. They've made it so easy. Today, all we need to do is pick an area of study. You don't need to choose a major before meeting with your advisor.
Areas of study?
Yeah, areas of study. It's like the field you want to work in. There are so many great options out there, and this helps you get on the right path. Once you pick your area of study, your advisor will help you pick the major that's the right fit for you. That way you don't waste a bunch of time or money taking classes you don't need.
How the heck do you know so much?
Well, I just sat down and watched a video just like this. So I can help you and explain. You see, there are 11 areas of study. Art and design, biological and physical sciences, business, education, computing and engineering technologies, health sciences, hospitality and culinary arts, humanities and communication, social and behavioral sciences, industry, manufacturing, construction and transportation, and public safety. Oh, I have an idea. Let's look at all the things you can be together. It'll help you pick your area of study in order to meet with your advisor.
Let's do this.
The world of art and design is a wonderful area of study. Imagine your name up in lights.
I can see it now.
What great career choices.
I can see it now.
You said that already.
I can.
Okay, let's move on. Biological and physical sciences can take you to careers for a better future. The innovations in this area of study are as impressive as its careers.
My friend Joe just told me the job growth for this industry is extremely fast.
Yep, pretty exciting opportunities.
Wow, what's next?
Let's talk business.
I thought we were talking areas of study.
That's exactly what we're talking about. Did you know that at CSN, the staff encourage students with an entrepreneurial spirit to explore their ideas and start their own business while still in school?
Cha-ching! Sweet. And being an entrepreneur is just one career opportunity in business, right?
That's right.
Incredible.
And we're just scratching the surface.
Speaking of careers, what about education?
Good question. The need for educators is strong, with hundreds of job openings in Nevada annually and many right here in Southern Nevada.
Education is such a rewarding career.
With possible jobs like a child care director, preschool teacher, middle school teacher, or even a special education assistant. And you get real hands-on experience while learning.
Do other areas of study have hands-on training?
Of course. Check out the computing and engineering technologies area of study, where you can be an unmanned aviation technician, like a drone pilot, and so many more. I can't believe this job is so fun. Going in for a landing. Oh, watch out!
Whoa. Wait, I heard that you can even land jobs, not just drones, before you graduate.
Very true, but this is just one of many areas of study that has immediate needs in our city.
Really?
Think about health sciences. CSN trains one-third of all nurses in Nevada alone, and health sciences has careers not just in nursing, but also in dental hygiene, optometry, and much more.
There is so much to discover in this field.
Let's see for ourselves.
I'm going in for a closer look. All these areas of study are making me hungry.
Well, just in time. Let's talk hospitality and culinary arts. There are over 250,000 people working in Clark County alone for this industry, more than double any other.
But I'm not great at cooking.
Marcus, there's a whole world out there in this area of study. Like casino management, hotel management, restaurant management, event planning, line cook, and pastry chef.
Ooh, I love a good creme brulee.
Terrific, because you know, in humanities and communication, you might be able to tell a lot of people what you love. You gain important skills to learn to work with people or be an information source.
Well, I always thought about being a news broadcaster someday.
Exactly. That's why looking at these areas of study is so helpful. They confirm what your interests are to get you in the working world as fast as possible. So, how do all of these areas of study make you feel?
Like I can be anything.
That's great, because you can. Which brings us to our next area of study, social and behavioral sciences. This has a wide range of careers that involve understanding how people behave and how to help them. But you can't choose social and behavioral sciences laying down on the job, so let's get going.
So I can study to be a pilot? I've always wanted to fly.
The sky is the limit in the industry, manufacturing, construction, and transportation area of study. With exciting career choices, you can...
I can help shape the future of this city.
Exactly.
Or I can save lives. The thought of serving and protecting our community sounds like something I'd really like to explore. My uncle was a police officer.
Then by studying public safety, you could follow in his footsteps or learn to help people in other ways.
First responders and other careers in public safety are so rewarding.
study today will help you decide on a major once you're admitted. Before classes start, you'll meet with an advisor just like I did and find which major is right for you. Choosing your area of study before your major saves you time and money and will put you on the right path to graduate on time, transfer, or start your career.
This really helped a lot. Can we run through the areas of study one more time?
Okay. We have art and design,
biological and physical sciences,
business,
education,
computing and engineering technologies,
health sciences,
hospitality and culinary arts,
humanities and communication,
social and behavioral sciences,
industry, manufacturing, construction, and transportation,
and public safety. So now you can decide what area of study you like best, and your advisor will help you choose your major once admitted.
Thanks, Gabby.
Ready to go?
Yep. I know exactly which area of study I'm going to choose.
Idea that this is watched at the front end of admissions when the student is filling out an application before they perhaps have ever interacted with any human being on one of our campuses, so they can make an informed choice or a semi-informed choice, engage in some additional career assessment testing and aptitude testing with that advisor upon entry into the institution. So we're really proud of that work, and I wanted to share publicly as well that the production company that's behind this work, a local production firm, has given us the green light to offer the template for any institution within INSHE that would like to use the base template of that animated video, customize it to make it your own at a grossly reduced price. So I'd be happy to share those contacts with you at any time. Last thing I'd like to share is our work around student basic needs. Of course, everyone around this table knows what we've been doing around our food pantries. We partnered with the Nevada Cooperative Extension, University of Nevada Cooperative Extension, received a great grant to open up our first formalized food pantries at all three of our campuses, in fact, right here in this building. And that's in partnership with Three Square as well. And also, you probably just saw the great campus commuter that we've just launched between NSC and CSN to help with our transportation needs across the valley here in the South. And finally, I'll close with this. You're all invited to our Southern Nevada Metro Momentum Student Success Summit, where our focus will be fundamentally on student basic needs and equity. We're bringing in some national renowned keynote speakers in this space. It'll be an opportunity for our institutions to gather, our leaders to gather, our community nonprofit safety nets to gather, to really continue the dialogue on what we can be doing more in the context of student basic needs and closing achievement gaps. So with that, we'll entertain any questions.
Are there any questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. We will move to item number 10 with Theo Meek. Thank you.
Good morning again, everyone. Theo Meek, research scholar with the Nevada System of Higher Ed. I am excited to be presenting findings from my latest policy paper on multiple measures. And while the presentation's getting pulled up, I will just mention very quickly that part of the conference that we, Crystal and I were at, Vice Chancellor Ava and I were at in Miami, was on the work of multiple measures and how multiple measures needs to be done conjunctively with co-requisite reform, as well as other system-wide or as well as other institutional reform practices, many of which you've heard most recently in the presentation from my colleagues at CSN, UNLV, and Nevada State College. Additionally, just yesterday, a revised version of the Core Principles for Transforming Remediation within a Comprehensive Student Success Strategy was released. I'd be happy to send that out to anyone who's interested. This, as many other system leaders have called it yesterday, is a GPS for success, or a guiding principle book on reforming higher education with a particular emphasis on developmental education. And this reaffirmed many of the points that our co-requisite mandate discusses, as well as what multiple measures I'll talk about today. So with that, I'll get started. Multiple measures, the concept behind multiple measures is using alternative placement mechanisms to maximize a student's placement into their gateway college-level math and English courses. There are a myriad of multiple measures. Most commonly that's used is high school information, whether it's cumulative GPA, academic GPA based on accumulation of math, English, natural science, and science and social science courses. It may be particular individual course-taking patterns within
a student's enrollment, such as enrollment in pre-calculus in high school, may lead to fulfilling a prerequisite. Of course, there's college transcripts, students coming in with transfer work. Additionally, folded in that is some MOOC courses, massively online open courses, open learning that you see out of Harvard X and others of the sort. Attitudinal surveys about a student's attitudes towards coursework. This is most prevalent in some of guided self-placement mechanisms, vocational or career aptitude interests, specialized certificates or licenses that typically wouldn't be credentialed, education and employment history, military training, individual interviews with students, and a holistic scoring process. Like I said, high school course-taking information is what I refer to as the lowest-hanging fruit with multiple measures. It's also the most researched and has the most promising results from what we've seen, and that was, again, reaffirmed yesterday in conversations with many of the individuals that helped author this, which include Achieving the Dream, the American Association of Community Colleges, Carnegie Math Pathways, the Charles A. Dana Center, Complete College America, Education Commission of the States, Jobs for the Future, and SOVA. So these are our industry leaders in guiding and supporting reform. Why multiple measures? Multiple measures is an imperative for the success of our students because it closes achievement gaps by increasing access to college-level coursework. Again, when you approach multiple measures from a disjunctive standpoint, that is maximizing a student's placement through any of the placement measures, you are giving the student the greatest benefit of access to college-level coursework. Now, you may be thinking, I'm putting this away because we've just passed a co-requisite mandate and we're not offering standalone remediation. Yes, that is true. However, with a multiple measures approach, especially as our institutions approach how implementation is going to look at their individual campuses, multiple measures are still incredibly important because it will provide students access to college-level coursework in situations where a student may not need the additional co-requisite support of one credit support, two credit support, three credit support. So multiple measures is incredibly important when we look at implementing. And co-rec, alongside the co-rec reform, again, is the most optimal time to be looking at doing this work because everything is up for grabs in the co-rec reform. Multiple measures also reduces a student's placement error rate caused by high-stakes placement, called the severe error rate, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. And this is a better deal for underrepresented minority students, adult learners, and all students. And I just want to emphasize in particular the all students. Up until yesterday, just yesterday, many of the intermediaries that I mentioned before were a little anxious to say that multiple measures is a better deal for everyone. But yesterday it was reiterated not once, not twice, but three times, this exact statement. No scenario where a single standardized high-stakes placement is an appropriate measure of student success. That was reiterated three times by three individual leaders, that there is no scenario where utilizing a single assessment measure is a better deal for students than in a multiple measures approach. So this work matters. This reform comes is really born from two research papers out of the Community College Research Center out of Teachers College Columbia. The Judith Scott Clayton paper, which you see some of the findings on the left, and the other paper also published in 2012. The authors' names are escaping me on the right-hand side. So both of these talked about a severe error rate. Now, a severe error rate is the idea that a student could have succeeded in the college-level coursework had they been given the opportunity to. However, because of placement, they were placed in developmental sequences. Now, this is used, Judith Scott Clayton, it goes very, very in-depth, and I'm happy to share this work with anyone who's interested, goes very in-depth about how she created that prediction modeling showed that a student would be able to earn a C or higher in the Gateway course had they been able to enroll. But her work identifies that 61% of all incoming students could have earned a C or better in the Gateway English course. However, only 19% were actually able to enroll. That means approximately 40% of students were required to take a developmental course However, according to her modeling, they could have been successful in the college-level Gateway course if given the opportunity to enroll. Additionally, 50% could have earned a C in Gateway Math, a C or better in Gateway Math. However, only 25% were able to enroll. The other 2012 study looks at college GPA and its and Accuplacer's relationship and finds that when you control for that second GPA bullet should say high school GPA, that when you control for high school GPA, the most prominent multiple measure, Accuplacer has absolutely no explanatory GPA, explanatory power in explaining a student's college GPA. In other words, Accuplacer cannot, is statistically does not influence college GPA, particularly when you control for high school GPA. Severe error rate, their study suggests that up to 33% of all students are misplaced into either college math, either math or English remediation, and the use of high school GPA reduces the severe error rate. When we look at SUNY's implementation of multiple measures, they saw gains just across the board with regard to placement, enrollment, and completion for mathematics and English. On the left side, you see math progression, placement, enrollment, and completion, and English placement, enrollment, and completion. And the summary is that you find gains across the entire board. This doesn't just provide access via placement and enrollment into the college level course, but it also provides higher completion rates for students. You see particularly high gains with regard to English. When we look at the Davidson County Community College, they've broken down their data by, they've disaggregated it by race and ethnicity, and overall we see increasing increasing success rates for all students, particularly African American and Latino students. Of those students that were placed using the high school GPA, not using a placement test only. Accuplacer is currently the most widely used placement tool across the system, apart from, of course, relying on ACT and SAT scores, which, when they were originally developed, were not intended to be used for placement. They were college access exams. And with Accuplacer, with the implementation of Accuplacer, there are a number of challenges, particularly inconsistent cut scores across NSHE. If I'm a student entering, at one of our institutions, I could be placed in a different course, even though I have the exact same Accuplacer scores, just due to the institution's implementation of Accuplacer. Benchmarking exercises in which the institution has the opportunity to customize Accuplacer, create an inconsistent test for NSHE students, and we hear from faculty constantly about its inability to accurately place students. Faculty concerns have been reinforced not only with what we heard yesterday and the day before at Strong Start to Finish convening, but also through national research, particularly out of the Community College Research Center. I'd like to give a special shout out to Nevada State College's approach of multiple measures. Their use of NROC's NREADY program is a wonderful tool for students to maximize their placement. NREADY is a diagnostic tool that utilizes personalized learning paths. The student takes a pre-exam, and then NREADY, as you heard Tony talk about, the student takes an initial exam. The EdReady program tailors and creates a specialized learning path for the student and then provides the student the opportunity for a post-exam in which the student can maximize their placement. And as you've heard from Nevada State College, they've seen a wonderful success rates with that. And it, most importantly, it's reducing the number of students placing into developmental mathematics and has the potential to reduce the number of students requiring co-requisite remediation that could go into a standalone college-level course, saving the students money. High school GPA and courses. Again, this is the most prevalent multiple measures used across the nation. There is a use of high school cumulative GPA, academic core GPA, or individual course performance. The Multiple Measures Assessment Project out of the Research Group for California Community Colleges, I actually had a chance to talk to one of their directors yesterday and got a lot more information about how they came to, but they've developed really, really robust decision trees that they have answered a lot of the questions on determining cut scores for GPA. For example, if a student has a 2.6 in a certain math course in high school, they may go into the college level course. If the student has a GPA along a certain cumulative GPA, alongside individual course taking. If, for example, the student completed a pre-calculus course, the student is able to maximize their placement into college-level coursework. The Multiple Measures Assessment Project is increasing the number of students who place and, more importantly, are successful in college-level coursework. So there's certainly a lot more that we can be doing with them to look at how they've scaled the work. They scaled the work alongside their implementation of a co-requisite mandate, but however, their co-requisite mandate was through state legislation, AB 705. For returning adults, there are two primary approaches. One that we hear from a lot of the institutions as of interest to them. Some are currently piloting programs, is on guided self-placement. That's having individualized conversations with the with returning adults to discuss and make sure that appropriate math and English courses are mapped to the student's desired career. Additionally, there is nothing to say that high school GPA, there is no research out there that says that high school GPA still isn't a strong predictor for returning adults. Multiple studies have shown that high school GPA is still a more accurate placement measure than a standardized test score even after 10 semesters of enrollment. So looking at high school GPA, again, even for returning adults who may be 10, 20, 30 semesters outside of their most recent course, high school GPA is still a stronger predictor of student success than making that student take an ACT, an SAT, or an ACCUPLACER. What we're doing with this information, we are taking this information to the NSHE statewide co-requisite implementation task force for their consideration. And I will say that they are already discussing this. Immediately upon the convening of this group, conversations have been, how do we scale the use of multiple measures? As you'll see in the policy paper that was accompanying this agenda item, our institutions of higher ed within the state are already using multiple measures. It's just now a matter of scaling it and sharing best practices across the system so that we scale this work across the system so that every student at every institution has the maximum, their ability to enroll into college-level coursework is maximized. So we're sharing this information with the task force to maximize a student's placement, again, by utilizing a disjunctive multiple measures approach, utilizing the highest placement. Now, I will say some state implementations of multiple measures, in my humble opinion, have missed the mark on implementation because they're using a conjunctive approach. In other words, they are putting everything into a black box algorithm where individual institutions come up with certain weightings that say, okay, their standardized placement scores are weighted at 25%, their high school GPA is weighted at 25%, our departmental exam is weighted at 50%, and then they're creating a placement. Flawed tools, when put together, create a flawed tool. When you look at a disjunctive approach where you look at a student's high school GPA and alone, give students better opportunity for access to college-level coursework. So again, that last point, scaling the existing multiple measures practices across the NSHE institutions. Our institutions are doing great work. They need to be supported in scaling that work. That is my presentation. I thought I had one more slide, but apparently not. Are there any questions about the policy paper, the multiple measures presentation, or future steps?
I don't hear any. Thank you.
All right, we will move to item number 11, new business. Is there any new business? Not hearing any. We will move to public comment. Is there any comment in Elko? In Reno?
No.
In Las Vegas? Here in Henderson? I see no public comment. The meeting is adjourned.